Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
Chuck O'Shelly, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Shelly!
April 9, 2020, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and despite the change in the sound of my voice slightly, this is the O'Shelly Effect, and I am your usual host, Chuck O'Shelly. Anyways, I'm sure you know that because you found the show, you decided to download the podcast, whatever. Doesn't matter, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome to it. It is a Thursday, as I said, April 9. So, you know, we are not doing the every other week thing that we do with Carmine, but somebody who often does accompany Carmine, and I'm always happy to get him by himself because makes for an entirely different conversation. Brand new book coming out soon, which, by the way, I have in my hands, but we're not discussing it tonight. In a couple of weeks, though, I guarantee you we're going to have to discuss this book, In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes. Oh, wait a minute. You know, it's partially obscured, the subtitle, because I have one of these reviewer copies here, and it's got a big old stripe across it. But anyway, In Denial is the main title. It's not the book we're talking about tonight, but it does, I happen to know, have something to do with Cuba and the interaction with the U.S. and probably a lot more, but that's not tonight's discussion. Instead, a book which we have covered before, but I dare say is relevant now for multiple reasons. Creating Chaos, also written by author Larry Hancock, who has written a great many books. You can go to larry-hancock.com, check out his blog, see the other books. Let's see, Someone Would Have Talked, Surprise Attack, the co-author of The Awful Grace of God, you know, a whole bunch of stuff, Unidentified. Larry, I don't want to name your books all day because I want to get to the discussion, but you've written many, and I advise you to check out anything that is written by Larry Hancock, because here's the fascinating thing. Much like they used to make baseball cards. Now, Larry's waiting to see where I'm going with this, I'm sure, before I actually get to saying hello. They used to make these baseball cards where on the one side of the card you had a picture, and on the other side you could create a puzzle out of the picture. So either way, depending on which way you wanted to flip the card around, you had something, either a part of a puzzle piece or something that stood alone. That is exactly what Larry Hancock's writing is like. You can read one of them, and you can get a standalone piece of information, an eye on history, on a particular narrow sort of subject matter. But if you turn around and take all these books and start to assemble them, you can get a greater portrait. So either way, you can get one or get all of them, but I do advise you to get something from Larry Hancock, and Creating Chaos would not be a bad book to start with, especially if you're interested in, oh, I don't know, things like Russia, the Soviet Union, how that transition, how the U.S. interacts with it. Interesting lens. I wonder why that's relevant today. Larry, I haven't given you a very good introduction here, but I know you're going to explain everything that I probably just said and a whole lot more because you are the context man anytime I have you on. So, first of all, how you doing? I'm looking forward to discussing Creating Chaos once more.
I'm doing great, and there's no doubt Creating Chaos is still in season, especially with an election coming up. So it's hard not to be contemporary with a title like that. Creating Chaos is the name of the book. It's also the way when I was in corporate America, some people referred to my management style, but that was long ago. So we'll kind of leave that behind us.
Oh, my, my. Were you a Trumpian kind of commander there where?
No, I think what it really came from is I was the type of manager who basically would circulate all the time, leave material all over the place. And then if somebody said they wanted a copy of a memo, I would say, look, I left it with you. You know, there's nothing in my cubicle. You must have it. Kind of a diversionary tactic.
Love it. Diversionary tactic. You know, I think diversionary tactics are going to have to come up. Now, here's an interesting piece of just something I'm going to throw almost like a monkey wrench into what you're going to talk about, but somehow I figure you'll make it part of the machine. You know, recently there have been many a debate about the information which comes from different nations. Why? Because of the coronavirus thing, right? And, gee, what about China, and what about what they should have reported, and what about what the WHO should have gathered, and what about what our intelligence agencies knew, and yada, 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 and on and on. And the ultimate conclusion for a lot of people is that China disseminates disinformation, doesn't report things accurately. Now, on the one hand, that is probably true. But on the other hand, it may not be as true as some people try to make it out to be. And in fact, I would say that China is not alone, nor are communist countries alone in, oh, I don't know, putting out information that is purposeful in guiding a narrative. And I think it's very interesting that we're watching people struggle with this idea that, well, gee, our CIA decided that they figured this out and they know that China under... And a lot of people that are screaming about that and screaming about how China doesn't report things and our CIA knew this and that, forget that our CIA is more than happy to release certain information for a purpose, withhold information for other purposes, and may not necessarily be acting with an agenda that is centered on transparency. But then again, what nation does? And then when you add Russia and what's going on with Saudi Arabia and the oil and what information is actually coming out, why are these strategies being loosed at this time? It is an interesting discussion and actually goes right into the wheelhouse of what you laid out in creating chaos, doesn't it?
It does, Chuck, and that's one of the reasons why I decided, I mean, creating chaos is largely a contemporary study of political warfare. But that's why the context for that book really starts with Machiavelli. The tactics in play, the strategies for information control, are nothing new. They've been practiced for centuries. Any nation state or any power that considers itself to be a geopolitical power, whether it's on a regional level or international level now, it would be naive to think that the people in charge of those states don't understand this, that they don't control information and use information as a tool and a tactic and a weapon. The man called it out in his book on how to practice that centuries ago, and that was warfare between regional powers within a fairly small area, the Mediterranean, kings and regents, adversaries against each other with the same practices that we see today. So it would be foolish to, well, it wouldn't just be foolish, it would be naive to think that China, Russia, the United States, any major contemporary power doesn't conduct itself in the same way. And protect information. Information is a weapon. It's a tool. So of course you don't release more of it than you have to. I think the only reason we sometimes get carried away is because there are states such as China and Russia, which now are much more firmly controlled. Their media is much more firmly controlled by the regime. That wasn't true for Russia a couple of decades ago when it had a much more open and free media. It certainly is true now. So when we set that down, we go, oh, gosh, they're controlling information. The bottom line is, so are we. We're just a lot less adept at it and have a much more open media than they do, whether or not the current administration likes that or not. That's the reality of the situation.
Well, even going back to Sun Tzu, right, you know, previous to Machiavellian concepts, one could say that Sun Tzu would not tell you to be transparent about what it is you're doing. you know, and you're operating in a situation where there is a warfare of intelligence, a warfare of information, a intellectual chess match, which is now played out on a grand scale, on a global scene, because, quite frankly, in most places, you have access one way or another to information that you would never have had access to only a couple of decades ago. So the game has changed. But the principles remain the same about deception. And, you know, when sometimes things that are called intelligence failures were not necessarily intelligence failures. They were measured reactions. And sometimes we find out many decades later what those, measured reactions were for. But this is a kind of a unique time period, I think, because of the accessibility on the one level of information. But, I mean, even when there was nothing electronic, even before the printing press, you controlled the rumors. You controlled the, you know, what was known by the people on the land. You know what I mean? This is what you did. And whether it was to strike fear in them with insane stories of the terrors that could be unleashed upon them by foreign armies or whatever, this was all the same kind of game. Again, just with different tools. The principles remain the same. You know, the battlefields change. The names change. But the concept remains the same, psychological warfare, one way or another, right?
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit last week when we were talking about disinformation. I think it's important to remember there are always three aspects to it: intelligence collection, intelligence control, and then the use of intelligence, weaponizing intelligence, basically. Mm-hmm. And I will maintain that in my studies, in the book Surprise Attack, I looked at a lot of several crises level incidents. And basically, I think you'll find is there's always intelligence of a threat. There's always intelligence. Intelligence is always pretty good. Not necessarily from a spy factor. A lot of it comes from open source intelligence. But as we talked about last week, you know, I expressed the fact that I thought that if and when we knew the full story, we would find that our intelligence community was very well aware of what was happening in China 2 to 3 months before it became discussed in the United States. And I suspected that there were briefings being done in by December. Now we know that to be true. The intelligence community is really pretty good. The problem of what happens next is a prioritization. You know, sort of like we have all sorts of intelligence. Which parts of it are we going to care about? Which parts of it are we going to prioritize? And that's when the game becomes really interesting, because whoever is in charge then maps that intelligence to their own agenda. And if it fits their political agenda, you know, gosh, can I use this for something? Then it goes into play. And if not, it just sits there. And sometimes it sets there until the threat becomes real. We saw that back in 2000 with the Millennium Terror threat. We saw that in 2001 with the attack on America. Sometimes you get intelligence and you act on it, and sometimes you just let it sit there and it bites you in the rear. So I think when we're talking about political warfare, we've got to remember that it's always those three elements. You're always looking. Even with people that are not a war or openly declared as adversaries or even, you know, supposedly friendly, they're always collecting intelligence. They're always disseminating it internally. And then it just depends on whether or not it fits with somebody's agenda as to whether you go to war with it.
Well, right. And I mean, even in the chat room, somebody dropped the link to the ABC News story, looks like, that explains, you know, well, I'll just read the headline. The intelligence report warned of coronavirus crisis as early as November, according to sources. You know, so as we speak, these things are being discovered. And who knows, there may be individuals who had an awareness of this even earlier That's a possibility. Now, will that come to light right away? Maybe, maybe not. Because, look, if somebody knew last year, say, that, you know, and I don't mean just November, but deep into last year, like, say, during the summer, that this was something that was emerging or could emerge somehow. I don't know how that works exactly, but let's just say that that's the case. Nobody might want that to come out because that would point to an extreme failure of our government to react, of many other governments to react, because the United States is not always a standalone organization either. So there are cooperative organizations where you have the U.S. and other nations who are supposed to be friendly who do share intelligence. So the next question will be, if the U.S. had this early, who did they share it with? And why did nobody sound the alarm early? And this is the case with a bunch of different things that emerge, not necessarily just the virus, but this happens, where you have intelligence that's collected, reports that are created, and again, like you said, there is a prioritization based on, well, always it seems to be shifting what it's based on, the priorities, right? Sometimes political expediency raises things up on the priority scale. Sometimes, the general attitude of the commanders of certain, let's call them facilities within the intelligence community or government, cause priority to be increased when it comes to certain things. You know, they're looking for problems with X nation, and you're telling them problems with, you know, A, B, C, D nation. They don't want to hear it very much, but you tell them about X. They're ready to go. Because that's what they were looking for based on the fact that they needed it for leverage. They needed it in order to push some other narrative, to increase military spending, to authorize new programs, to bring new justifications for budgets to Congress. Sometimes there are political concerns here, too, aren't there?
There are. And one observation that leads me to is we were really good at playing this game during most of the Cold War. And when we were outwardly focused, our intelligence agencies had lots of connections. I would think it's safe to say our intelligence was trusted, probably among the Western powers. Only the British and the U.S. had intelligence that was as trusted. And we were quite good at, when something like this came up, at essentially leaking it, usually passing it through two or three cutouts, very likely passing it through other intelligence services as cutouts to a place where it might do some good. And in all honesty, if this had happened during that period of time, I wouldn't have been at all surprised to see this intelligence that we had back in November, December leaked to the World Health Organization or to other independent bodies to kind of get them to take a look at what might be going on in China. In all honesty, we've lost a good bit of that. We aren't as trusted or as respected as we used to be. And who knows, as you're saying, it will be ages before we really know who had what when. But I wouldn't be surprised that at this time we didn't even try.
Let me help to illustrate something here, though, because when you say that they could have leaked it, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily know what that means. Here's a key issue. There's a reason why certain people in the media seem to always have unnamed sources in the intelligence community. That is one method by which things are leaked. Simply someone is contacted. Look, I'm your guy. You know, I'm in the know. Here's what you need to know. And it does tend to land on the same desks quite often, doesn't it? So,
yeah,
go ahead.
It does, and it can be. I think we're more familiar these days of leaking to media assets, although that was always common. I mean, you can trace that back to who got what story. One of the most embarrassing leaks that I can think of is when there was a news report written about a coup in a certain Latin American country, and it was published the day before it happened. Well, afterwards, we found out one of the CIA officers involved leaked it to his good media buddy, and they got their schedule out of sync, and that actually came up in a congressional investigation. So, you know, that's one way to do it. The leaks I was thinking about are more in the nature of, you know, someone would pass that to their counterpart within another intelligence agency, foreign agency, who would pass it to someone else, who would attribute it. You know, and by the time it gets to the right body, it's more like a lead. You know, it's not really a story. There's not a lot of detail. It's more like, you know, you trust me enough so that you go take a look at this. And that's the kind of, it's not a leak so much as basically a nudge or a warning or something of that nature. Used to be quite common. The British were very good at doing that sort of thing during World War One, for example. They took their own information that they had collected about the Germans operating in Mexico and leaked it through American intelligence so that they did not give up their source. It's kind of like, well, we don't want the Germans to know that we're monitoring their cable traffic, so our good buddies, the American, will leak it to their press as if they did it, you know.
So that, I think they called it discussions.
Pretty complex.
Yeah, I think they called that discussions among gentlemen. And what they would do is arrange to have a discussion. Like, really, it sounds funny, but like, you know, they sit down and they have their scotch together. And, you know, listen, I'm going to tell you something. And of course, if you ever mention it to anyone, I'll deny that it came from me. But this might be useful information to you, chum. And it's a funny thing how a lot of information traveled at the time of, like, say, World War One in this way. And I read about that. I can't remember whose book it was in. That, you know, they used, like, these different attachés, for lack of a better word, just these guys who were supposed to be on diplomatic missions that would show up under the guise of something else really to deliver one of these messages. And these things would get handed off, and not necessarily directly to the, like, imagine you have a British guy who wants to leak this to an American. So what he does is go to, oh, I don't know, the Canadian guy and say, you need to tell the American this. And now the Canadian has secondhand information that he gives to the American, and then it goes through to, well, gee, I better tell our intelligence agency about it. Of course, we didn't have a CIA back then. But we certainly had some level of intelligence operatives in the military. So that's where that would usually go, right? I mean, this is a kind of odd sort of, I don't know, game of human telephone that was played.
It's a type of human intelligence. And it's, I mean, you know, sometimes the information is good, sometimes it's not. Everybody's cautious with it. But that was one of the real strengths of what I would call partnering. And especially when you're talking about global intelligence, let's face it. One country may have very good human intelligence sources in a region where we have none. For example, currently the French have excellent intelligence sources in parts of Africa where we have no reach at all. And can have very valuable information for us. The same is true for the British and other nations as well. Mexico has information out of Latin America. So we were always very good when, you know, if you want to play in that global geopolitical field, you need to be friends with all these people, and they need to trust you. Because if they don't trust you, this is not going to happen. And I have to say, in recent years, I mean, one thing you don't do, and I'm sorry, but you don't badmouth your own intelligence community repeatedly and maintain that kind of international trust. You also don't disclose operations in tweets and compromise your own intelligence service. And if that seems pointed, it is, because this is the real world and you get measured on things like trust. And if the people at the top of your own national community are disparaging your intelligence people and actually compromising its information, then guess what? you just blew that trust. And a lot of what we spent decades putting together in terms of an international, these dialogues that you were talking about, mm-hmm. has pretty well been blown to pieces over the last few years.
Right. Well, and here's the thing. Vladimir Putin is quite a player. and why do I say that? Because, look, the guy has been at the ground level of intelligence before. You know, before his storied history as the de facto dictator of Russia, which, you know, regardless of what political office he holds, let's be honest, the guy holds sway over the intelligence community in Russia, certainly keeps control over the country for the most part, and has maintained that and appears to want to maintain that, oh, I don't know, until he dies. So, quite frankly, a guy who starts out being trained in this kind of stuff, okay, a guy who was, you know, the mayor of Moscow, I think, at one point, right, but then graduates to a much more prominent position, holds on, in fact, and still stays as part of the structure despite the fact that the Soviet Union fell and Russia is now standing alone, then becoming the Russian Federation. You have an interesting transitional figure here who knew what the Cold War was like, who knew what those strategies were like, and today plays on the global stage, you know, in quite a fascinating way, especially considering that he has even more control over his media, I think, than the Soviet Union used to have, which is fascinating. Although you did note, maybe 20 years ago or so, that was not the case. But with the emergence of RT and Sputnik in the way it is now, guess what? You have a guy who seems to be quite a bit in control of all the media that's coming out of his country, and certainly the stuff that's getting heard in other languages around the world. So, when we try and put this in context, and we talk about what you have in your book, okay, where should we begin to unpack this, especially considering that he's a player at the moment with this whole interesting interplay with Saudi Arabia and the oil, and pretty much crashing the value of oil at exactly the time that at least one third of the world is on lockdown because of the coronavirus. Let's make oil cheap. Let's add to the economic problem here. In a way, that was a fascinating strategy. And I think actually it was a lot more than just for financial benefit. I think it was an assertion, a message to others who sought to interfere with his affairs, quite frankly. And I think that this is the kind of level he operates on. Yeah, there might be a financial gain. This may be to increase the power and reach of Russia in general. But also, there is a communication going on here, which I think is much more sophisticated than the average onlooker understands. Do you think I'm crazy?
No, not at all. I think they're what we've largely not grasping in this is Putin had his roots in the KGB. He understands how this game is played. He understands how it's played with official government entities like the SVR and the current Russian intelligence and security agencies. Right. But what he has brought to the party is something amazing, really, under, I'm not sure I want to call it capitalism. It certainly is capitalism in Russia with the oligarchs. I write about it in Creating Chaos in a chapter called Privatization. And I write about it again in Denial in the last part of the book, extending that to some contemporary. What Putin has managed to do is to translate all of the tools and all of the tactics that he learned in the KGB into the private sector. And because of his financial and personal relationship with his oligarchs, he has privatized everything from intelligence collection internationally to actual political warfare, and even beyond that into covert action. You see that primarily. You saw the first instance of it in Syria, you're seeing it in Africa now, although we're not seeing it in our news because we have virtually no international news anymore, which is another one of his successes, by the way. But so I think there are two elements, Chuck. One you're calling out is the sense that Putin has managed to come up with using economic weapons, using commercial weapons as tools in his portfolio to pursue his geopolitical agenda. He's using those in Western Europe. He's using them in Africa. Quite frankly, up until this, he blew his first thrust to move oil and essentially take over the energy economy of Western Europe. He blew that, and I talk about that at length in Creating Chaos. Mm-hmm. Now he's come back with a second approach to that. The reason he blew it the first time was we still looked pretty trustworthy and pretty reliable and, you know, a good partner at that point in time. At this stage of the game in 2020, we don't look like that good a partner for Europe, quite frankly. And I think it would be hard to deny that given the last 2 or 3 years. We don't look that reliable. We look a bit dysfunctional. And Putin's coming back from a sense of power and saying, hey, I'm in control. I'm much more reliable than they are. I can make your energy cost go up or go down as I choose. They are at my mercy. We're no longer at their mercy. Right. And he's doing the same thing in Africa in a totally different venue. So long-winded answer to your point. Yes, Putin is still playing geopolitics. I don't see that we are. He has a very well laid out international strategy. I don't see that we have one. And he's using both economic and political warfare and integrating them in a way that we certainly, I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm simply saying that he knows what it is and he's doing it while we're just sort of sitting on the sidelines.
Well, here's one thing that happened since Creating Chaos was published, right? The whole shift of assets in Syria. Because I think that wasn't actually happening, or maybe it was just happening when you were going to press with Creating Chaos, right?
You're absolutely correct. That's why I kind of pursued it in the new book. In Denial deals with Russia in Syria and in Africa.
Right. Well, it's because that strategy was unfolding while you were writing about it. But quite frankly,
hard to keep up.
Yeah, it was very hard to keep up. I think you actually delayed releasing Creating Chaos a couple of times because there was new information coming in, right? So it was kind of hard to figure out where to stop. Since then, though, I think that Putin masterfully played the whole Syrian situation. Because, look, at this point, basically a vacuum was created when the U.S. troops were moved, not removed, but moved to a different section, right? Now they're over there guarding oil, in quotes. You know, that was the last we heard of it. Of course, it's no longer in the headlines here. But what happened? Well, the Kurds were punished. We knew about that. That all went down, and the Turks came in, and the Russians basically took operational superiority away from everybody in a whole section of Syria. I mean, unless I'm reading it wrong, Larry, I mean, that's what looked like happened. And
no, they did. And that allowed them to advertise themselves as, now, we got to remember reality and propaganda are two different things, but that allowed Putin to claim that he essentially had brought peace to their area. You know, he's setting up joint security patrols with the Turks, with the U.S., and it was at Russia's initiative. Mm-hmm. And that became his propaganda. The reality on the ground is far different, but you're not seeing any of the reality on the ground. I defy anyone to relate to me the recent actual engagements between American patrols and Russian patrols in northern Syria. That's not made the headlines anywhere.
Well, forget about the American MSM carrying it, because according to them, we withdrew, right? So we're no longer there. What would there be to cover, Larry?
Well, you're right. And as you said, what pains me, and I don't understand it at all. We are there in some of those security controls. We're also there guarding the oil. I don't have any idea, and I've seen no writing on where that oil is going and who's buying it and where the money is going. For all I know, we could be guarding oil that is actually going, in terms of revenues, back to the Syrian regime. We just don't even know.
Well, see, that's a funny question.
And there are no foreign correspondents, so we don't have any reporting on it at all.
Yeah, well, where's the reports from Syria right now? Nowhere. And you're exactly correct. Okay, they're guarding oil. Let's assume that that is true. All right, so who are they guarding it for? Does that mean that the Assad regime now has American protection for its oil? Wait a minute. I thought that was why we were engaged over there. Because we weren't exactly happy with the Assad regime. Of course, the we, I mean, is the American military apparatus. Not me, not you, Larry. But, you know, I kind of got a little confused, and then the story disappeared. And I dare say there's still action on the ground there, just nobody can see it. You know, if a regime falls in the woods, I don't know, Larry. You know, I'm just saying, it is an odd study in the way this is played. But one thing I can confidently say is that this is a victory for Putin, because whatever's going on over there, no one has eyes on it. I don't think anything has come up in the UN about it. Quite frankly, I mean, there was a bit of bemoaning the fate of the Kurds temporarily in public, right? How could we just, you know, leave our allies hanging? Oh, well, that's America. Moving on. You know, it just, that was a weird sort of thing, and I just didn't understand why that was acceptable, but then realized that the narrative was meant to die quickly. You know, and I'm not saying I understand the full purpose of that, but I think that is a serious victory for Putin right there, because that makes a handful of allies pretty happy. That allows Russia to honor, because remember, Russia had an aggression, an aggression pact where in Syria, allegedly, right, if they were invaded, Russia was supposed to lend them a hand. And I mean, that was my understanding of the agreement with the Assad regime. Maybe I misunderstood it. But in that case, maybe that's actually what's going on here. And, okay, pay no attention.
I think the pay no attention is about right. Without a doubt, on the world scene, Putin, from a propaganda standpoint, has had a major win in Syria. If you turn it around, Iran has had a major win in Iraq. As far as information control, I don't know if you noticed today, an international commission finally delivered its report and said, without a doubt, Assad, a year ago and on an ongoing basis, has been using chemical warfare. One of the things we swore that we would not permit without any retaliation. We're no longer in a position to retaliate. Plus, I have not seen that report make it into any major coverage. So the bottom line is that's going on. We're ineffectual in Syria. In Iraq, we signed an agreement to turn over the largest military base that we had to the Iraqis. And we're just kind of gradually, with nobody moving out while Iran is moving in. And again, I'm not even saying this is what it is. I'm not saying we should stay in Iraq, but on the global scene, we're just not any longer very respected as a partner. And when that happens from a geopolitical standpoint, the adversary wins. And reason I introduce it in that way, I mean, there are three levels of political warfare that I talk about in creating chaos.
Right.
And one of the most effective is what I refer to as fragmentation. And a big part of fragmentation is kind of defocusing your adversary, getting their attention to turn inwards, creating internal chaos so that they're not looking at what they're doing. You're not the first thing they think about. They're not responding to you. And that really is what has happened from 2015 through 2020, is that that program of fragmentation against the U.S. has been carried out extremely effectively. We are now almost totally internally focused. It would be hard to say that we have a global strategy of any point. And it's all been done very, you know, Putin didn't have to say he was going to bury us. Remember that from the Cold War? I mean, it just goes ahead and executes while we're not. That's one of the things that amazes me. Can you believe 5 or 6 years ago that there literally would have been a total cessation of international media coverage? Even without the pandemic, even on a good day last fall, how much international news coverage did you really have? You had a ton of political news coverage, domestic. International, hit and miss.
Yeah, hit and miss, and even then there were the generalized stories, you know, what's gone on in the parliament or this and that, you know, the on the ground kind of like I'm actually here and looking at the situation, on the scene reporting. I've talked about this for the past couple of years, how it's evaporated. It used to be one of the things that I liked the BBC for. Now my friends on the other side of the pond would yell at me and tell me about how bad it was. And I would tell them, yeah, but there's nothing here. So as silly as you think the BBC is, at least they still had some reporters out there. But now lately, as I scan that, they don't have it either. Nothing. Everything has been, seemingly designed to draw most Western nations into internal conflict, coverage, attention. And that's before the virus, mind you, which now everything is virus. But, I mean, I'm just saying before that, though, you know, we had the Brexit thing over in the UK, right? And everything was about that, just over and over. The struggles there, the political wrangling, the prime minister resigns, so on and so forth. Theresa May has to go and ask the Queen to form a government, and maybe she won't give consent, and you know, so on and so, it was all that. No longer were we like, well, what's actually going on somewhere else, right? So it almost seems like it was intentionally designed this way. And, well, see, now here's where I get into an odd situation with some people where I say, you know, they say, oh, you know, these like Russian troll farms and all this, none of it was effective. Well, not in and of itself, maybe. But if you combine it with some other sweeping changes, it seems to me as though a general sort of steering of attention to have it focused inward as opposed to outward. Somebody did that. And I'm not sure that everybody just woke up one day and said, you know, let's isolate ourselves to our more localized problems, but not really get truly local, just to be superficial about it. You know what I'm saying here, Larry? It's a weird sort of design that kind of emerged over the past couple of years, and I don't even want to lay it at the feet of you know, the grand orange marshal there. I want to say that this is something that started a couple of years before, you know, he went down the escalator, it seemed like.
What? Yeah, I think you'll find it starting in 2014. To your point, Chuck, I literally offer this challenge. If anybody reads Creating Chaos and would like to debate with me that the Russian fragmentation campaign against the United States did not work and was not effective, I would be happy to do that, because I think the case I make in Creating Chaos, and it's been made by other people, is inarguable. Now, obviously, to understand why that's true, no, they're troll farms. Troll farms are just what they're supposed to be. They're seeding tools. They're not going to overwhelm you and change. What they do is it's like judo. Basically, you don't have to be bigger. You don't have to be heavier. You have to gain a point of leverage.
Right.
And that's the point that we're talking about in this. You look at what the opponent's issues are. What's currently fragmenting a nation? Is it race? Is it economics? Is it politics? Is it religion? Let's say that you pick out and you pick out half a dozen elements of each where there's obviously discord. Mm-hmm. But it's not at a high level. It's not, you know, it's just there. Then you set off your trolls and you exacerbate it and you tweet and you retweet and you get to the point where people within that country who are otherwise sane are actually retweeting your memes,
right,
which happened in 2016. And it's not your campaign that wins. It's your leveraging their citizens and their politicians and their, if you want to call it, their shock jocks, because you want to go out and influence people that already have large audiences. And one of the things I point out in Creating Chaos is the Russian trolls were immensely effective at planting stories and memes within American public entities, media entities, that already had a huge reach. Mm-hmm. They just planted those seeds and they carried on for them. So, it really amazes me that people don't think that their campaign was effective. It had nothing to do per se with Trump's political campaign. He wasn't doing it. They were doing it and they were looking literally to create fragmentation. That's the whole point of any of this.
Right.
Without elaborating too much, the point is there are three stages of political warfare that I discuss in the book. One is active measures, and that goes beyond on all the time with any adversaries, any large political entities. Then you have shaping, where you try to just innocuously influence your adversary's policies to match yours. And a lot of that was being done 2014 through 2016, 2017. And then finally you have fragmentation. And what you really want to do in fragmentation is you literally, it's like a fifth column. It's breaking apart your adversary so that they're so totally focused on infighting and acting against each other that they just suddenly forget you're there and you can go along with your own agenda unhindered. They don't really oppose you in any organized fashion anymore because they're so much into infighting. And if somebody doesn't, if that didn't happen between 2014 and now, I just don't understand why you can't see it, you know.
Well, I'll give you a good, ugly, controversial example, and I hope I don't make you uncomfortable. But here's what I can observe, and it's about one of the most divisive possibilities that was loosed upon us during that time, by individuals who chose to shape things and chose to propagandize in order to stoke, not create, but literally just stoke existing problems. And it goes like this. Ready? You have the individuals who were concerned that, quite frankly, and it is true, that quite a lot of black men had died in police interactions, period. I'm not going to get into justified, wasn't, who, or anything else. That was making headlines. It was definitely creating an emotional response. Now, if you can figure out a way to take those individuals and kind of put them in the same room, virtually, with individuals who were angry but not willing to say so publicly, were angry that the socialist Barack Obama was destroying America, okay? And that's the way that they saw the world. You put those two people together, they're going to interact and tear at each other. And if you can combine them into, chat rooms, Twitter discussions, Facebook groups, and you can get them to actively engage with one another, guess what they're going to spend time doing? amping it up, telling their friends, getting angry, and reacting to just that. And it's two pre-existing conditions that you didn't build, but you took to your advantage. And there was a whole breadbasket of racial divisiveness that was thrown into this. Black Lives Matter, there was Russian Black Lives Matter groups out there, right, which were based with these troll farms that were making outlandish statements, literally attempting to antagonize the individuals who really didn't want to say the N-word in public when it came to Barack Obama, but they were directly engaging with and antagonizing individuals like that. So that this whole narrative about the Black Lives Matter group or a bunch of terrorists became part of what was going back and forth. Wasn't even created necessarily by the Russian trolls, but because you took two divisive groups of individuals who were guaranteed to have a virtual fistfight with one another, they put them in the same bar and served them vodka. I mean, that's basically what went on there. I know that's a really blunt, crude way to put it, but Larry, I saw proof of this where there were these, again, poorly worded. I mean, clearly somebody is having trouble recognizing the nuances of English, but they discovered that they had, you know, Russian bases when it came to these different, like, accounts and stuff like this that were literally doing this. So you do that, and what you have is a public which now is engaged with battling with each other. Political discourse becomes, well, not dominated by it, but tainted by it all over the place, right? And I'm sure there was work, groundwork done long before that, but we know that there's evidence for that. Now, I'm not saying that that swung the country or made the country more hostile. I mean, the hostility was already there. It's just, again, if you're going to put these people together purposely, you know what you're going to get. And this is what was done. And it's just like, what would the intent be for that outside of fragmentation? Because if you have an ununified American public who is now, you know, thirsting for their own personalized echo chambers to feed their belief systems, well, here you go. And you do that. You give them a little bit of food and tell them where the restaurant is, and they will dine on it. I mean, I don't know, man. It just seems to me like it's easy to see. It's not easy to capture, you know, with numerical science necessarily about how this shifted the population's view or how this creeped into political discourse or social discourse or harmony in your local community or anything else. It's not easy to quantify it. But the ABCs are there, Larry. I don't know. Am I getting confused as I explain this? Kinda. But I know it's there. Well, go ahead.
One of the points, of course, is it increases tension and it sensitizes people. And the more you sensitize people, the more they get tense about virtually anything. You know, that, so you want to level, you want to heat things up, basically, from thermodynamics. All of these individual actions add a heat to the matrix, which always makes the social dynamic more challenging.
There you go.
Anytime you heat it up, I bet one could do a study of how much it heated up. That would be feasible. A concrete example, I cover some of these in the book, of what you just stated was in Philadelphia. There was an extensive series of posts online trying to call for rallies at one of the places where one of these confrontations had occurred and a young black man had been killed. And one of the local black ministers was kind of taken aback about it because it wasn't coming from anywhere in the black community. Mm-hmm. Long story short, it was a Russian troll farm. Mm-hmm. He contacted them, but that was it. And they targeted, you could find it. There were 7 or 8 of these incidents in metropolitan areas around the nation, and they targeted each and every one of them. A more humorous, if you want to call it that, example, they covered the bases. We even know that they tried to encourage, now this may look more important from Russia than it does from here. There are separatist movements in Texas and California, mm-hmm. and have been for some time, trying to either split the states and essentially secede part of the state from the other part of the state or from the Union. Texas is big about that. The Russian trolls started organizing Facebook groups and Twitter feeds for these movements. And that got exposed because eventually some of the people who were already in this, I mean, this is something that already existed before they showed up. So no,
I know for a fact the Republic of Texas movement has existed for quite a while. There's a couple of different organizations that would, quite frankly, and they're organic American groups that feel as though it would be best for the state of Texas to return it to the Lone Star status it once had, where it was an independent state and not part of the United States and not part of Mexico. There was a time period in our history where that was true, Larry, and there are some people who would like it to go back that way.
They tend to be more animated. Again, you want to do this to the groups that tend to be more vocal and might be more antagonistic and more radical, because what you really want to do is you want to provoke conflict. And this one was exposed because some of these guys who are already in these movements, you know, would join these groups and there would be rallies called, and they got curious why the people who were calling these rallies never showed up in person. Well, now we know they didn't show up in person because they were like several thousand miles away on the other side of the globe. But that's, and the thing is, all you have to do is seed that, and you seed the tension, and unfortunately, people that want to believe those sorts of things, if you target them correctly, don't really exercise much filtering. All you really have to do is say things they already believe. And I'll give you an example that I just saw yesterday. It was a Facebook post, one of my friends saying, you know, Facebook is so liberal and so radical that they won't allow the Lord's Prayer to be posted on Facebook. And we need to protest. And, you know, we need to get mad about this. I'm going, interesting. So I immediately did a Google search and immediately found, half a dozen Facebook posts for the Lord's Prayer with tens of thousands of views of each one of them. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to my friend and said, you know, I think that might not be true. And no response, because nobody ever responds when somebody, you tell them like, you're gullible. But it doesn't take much. All you've got to do is figure out what people are tense about anyway, and you can turn it on a dime. And that's what real, political warfare is like. So you don't have to have, a room full of well-targeted posters on the internet can gain a lot of traction.
Mm. No, this is a funny thing, is I've seen people say on, and Facebook's a funny place anymore, where they actually say in their post, if you say this word and that word, they will ban you from Facebook. So I look at it, I realize it's been a couple hours, and I type back to the person, have you been banned? Because you just used the words. and they're not banned. It's a very weird thing where I don't know where they get their information sometimes, but yeah, it gets them upset in one way or another. Now we got to protest, or we got to make a point of this, or it's very interesting when a lot of this stuff is not real. And, I don't know who does that either, but I've seen this kind of stuff before too, where it's like, you can't say this and that. And I'm like, okay, so have you been banned? Cause you just said it. So what is your,
and why am I seeing your next post?
Yeah, like, and then they respond, well, some people get banned for this. Well, you didn't. I don't know. It's just, are you sure it wasn't something else somebody said? You know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, I've seen some weird things where people have gotten booted from social platforms for some odd reasons. I had to fight with YouTube. And after they independently viewed all of my stuff, they said I didn't violate anything. And there was no justification for removing me. But it didn't stop them from removing me for about a year. You know, it was very odd stuff goes on, and I don't know how to explain it because, look, I'm not on the inside of all these things. But, you know, there's such an interesting edge to this, and we're going to take a break now. But when we get into the next hour, I want to ask Larry Hancock to explain to us the difference between propaganda and disinformation, because is there a difference? I don't know. Sometimes I use these words interchangeably. Maybe I'm not exactly correct when I do. But I'd like to talk about that, and we're going to continue to talk about Creating Chaos, which is the title of a book. I'm going to give you the link to it in the show notes. I'll try and drop it in the live chat room at Ocelli.com, which we have going on as we speak. But meanwhile, I'll return with Larry Hancock in the next hour. Stick around. It's going to get deeper.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite them? How do you make them feel as one with you?
I don't know how.
Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, the thing that is most of the essence is that you make this mob an extension of yourself.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination spoken to her claim?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Carmine Savastano. Human time bomb. The violence within our nature poses significant questions and considers the evidence that violence shapes the past and present. Author and professor David T. Beato calls it an impressive tour de force. Savastano shows a mastery of relevant work in biology, anthropology, and intelligence. Each chapter will challenge readers to rethink old assumptions. Doctor of Psychology R. Blackstock notes, "It is a long, hard look into the potency of our collective shadow that is extremely relevant in today's socio-political climate." Historian and author Larry Hancock declares, "This work is a slap on the back of the head, a wake-up call, and a serious reality check as to the true human condition." Order your digital and print copies now on Amazon.com. For more information, visit tpaak.com.
I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. You're going to have mental depression for people. You're going to have large numbers of suicides. Take a look at what happens in a really horrible recession or worse. So you're going to have tremendous suicide. But you know what you're going to have more than anything else? Drug addiction. you will see drugs being used like nobody's ever used them before, and people are going to be dying all over the place from drug addiction. I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. You're going to have mental depression for people. You're going to have large numbers of suicides. Take a look at what happens in a really horrible recession or worse. So you're going to have tremendous suicides, but you know what you're going to have more than anything else? Drug addiction. You will see drugs being used like nobody's ever used them before, and people are going to be dying all over the place from drug addiction.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all powerful people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media.
The second hour of the O'Shelley Effect begins now, and my guest tonight is Larry Hancock. If you go to larry-hancock.com, you can read Larry's blog, which I believe he said he blogged about the show he was going to do with me coming up. And also, you can find out about his books. You can take a look at a great many things that Larry has thought about over the past few years, for sure, over there at larry-hancock.com. My apologies for my voice. It's not in the best of shape tonight, but I'm doing the best I can. My mind is working fine, and I'll tell you what, this discussion about how information is utilized really is a broad topic. We are talking about the book Creating Chaos once again. I want to get into some specifics about it, but generally, I felt as though we should discuss in the first hour some stuff that, well, happened after that book went to presses, and also give a general overview about, well, disinformation, the use of certain types of assets in the modern age here, and how really it hasn't changed the game exactly, although, like I said, the toys have gotten more sophisticated. The techniques remain the same. So this is an interesting thing. And also, this hour with Larry, we're going to discuss the difference between misinformation and, there are campaigns of misinformation, and there is also propaganda, which is a slightly different thing, I guess, but also disinformation, I guess, is a little bit different than misinformation. But I don't know. I'm going to actually hand that over to Larry and have him walk me through this a bit, because there's a lot to this, and there's a lot of nuance, and it's not just a matter of semantics. There are different uses for information, the lack thereof, the control of information, don't let this leak out, but do let this little thing leak out, and so on and so forth. There's a lot to it. It's not just a matter of, hey, every time I see a politician or I see somebody who is involved in international affairs, every time I see them speak, they're always lying. And, of course, the news media is always lying. And on the one hand, I can't always argue with you. But on the other hand, there are nuances to this, and it's not always about the lies. It's not always about the omissions. Sometimes it's about getting you to pay attention to particular things that are cherry-picked, for lack of a better word. But I'm going to turn it over to Larry and see if he can explain this with us really quick before we get into some more explanations about stuff that are in the book Creating Chaos, which, by the way, I highly recommend. I have a copy of it myself, and I was kind of astonished with the way that Larry laid it out. But then again, Larry is a great author, and like I said earlier, you can take any one of his books, and yeah, you have a standalone piece, but if you start to put them together, you'll also see a grander portrait, really focusing on 20th century history, but everything from the JFK assassination to the Cold War to, oh well, gee, how did the national security state react to things that could go into the UFO category? Yeah, all of that Larry Hancock has covered, and a lot more, including the assassination of Dr. King, other violent actions that have occurred, a surprise attack, another good book, by the way, that explains the behaviors of some of these organizations when events occur, whether they are by design, by allowance, by mistake, it's irrelevant. There are certain things to understand about all of those. Anyways, back to it. Creating chaos is what we're talking about tonight, Larry. And like I said, propaganda versus misinformation or disinformation. How about we begin there and then get into some more specifics from the book?
Sure. And I think, obviously, the lines get blurred at some point. But I'll just go through what I found to be particularly useful to me in studying these things. And really, perhaps the place to start, I'd mentioned to Chuck, part of my career was spent in advertising and marketing and public relations. So in reality, you also have to start with what's called spin. I don't think there's any adult that wouldn't expect that when you're talking with other people or you're getting communications from organizations, whether they're corporations or businesses or political campaigns, that they're going to configure the information to appeal to you and to make themselves look good and avoid areas where they don't look good. I mean, it's just naive not to expect that.
Right, Larry. So the thing is, really quickly, I know I was going to backhand that part of that into it. After you said a little bit, I was going to say, and by the way, but Larry does have a background in marketing and public relations, and I'm very sure, Larry, that you're familiar with, like, Edward Bernays and the individuals who created the concept of, you know, what we used to call Madison Avenue marketing, and all the things that go in that toolbox. You're aware of how that functions. So there is a retail or a I guess it's a retail version of that, and then there's sort of the I don't know what to call it, the public and private partnership of the governmental aspect of that. And they are interchangeable in that, guess what? What is effective works when it comes to selling anything, whether it is, a potato chip, a stick of deodorant, or if it's selling an idea, a narrative, a piece of history, a concept of viewpoint on the world stage. Actually, all of those sort of marketing concepts apply here, don't they?
Yeah, and basically it's information management. And there's nothing, it's just the way of the world. I suspect every individual behaves the same way. You manage your own information. You know, you tell people what you want them to hear about you and try to avoid telling them the bad things. So, and we shouldn't be surprised when information management is moved over into another venue like politics. The thought of politicians always lie? No, politicians always manage information, just like corporations do, just like individuals do. No surprise there. So it sometimes surprises me to think that people would be, expect them to behave differently. We all expect this. So what is I think a good practice is just to step back from that and just not assume, you know, everybody is bad because everybody always lies. That's just not the way it is. They manage information for purposes. And when we're talking about political warfare and shaping and those sorts of things, though, it's I think productive to look at the difference between propaganda and disinformation. Propaganda, historically, is simply taking information management into the broadest media possible. If you look at the propaganda efforts of nations during wars, you know, of course, you have a lot of propaganda going on. You want to tell your side that you're winning. You don't tell them generally as little as possible about the battles you're losing. You want to tell the other side about the battles they're winning and a lot about the battles they're losing. You know, it's still just information management. For those who've studied history, you know, every nation during a war has a media spokesperson, whether it's Tokyo Rose for the Japanese during World War II or the equivalent in Germany or Britain. They all have spokesmen who tell, you know, as to as many people possible over as many radio channels or as many media outlets as possible, their version of events. And propaganda in general is two-sided, but the most effective propaganda is positive, where you can convey a message to encourage the people on your side that you're winning, that you're doing the right things, that they should be confident in you. So there are always two streams, the one that you broadcast to your side and the one you broadcast to the other side. But I think, Chuck, what I'm really trying to say there is propaganda is relatively open because it has to get to as many people as possible, and it's identified with you. You know, people know it's a message coming from an identifiable source, so they may be just a little skeptical, but they generally want to hear it. And it's not hidden. Propaganda is obvious. People laugh at it. People believe at it, believe it, you know, but it's out there. It's public. You know the source, and it's broad messaging, which is totally different from the types of dirty tricks that are used in disinformation, because disinformation is planted. It's generally speaking, you're not supposed to know the source of the disinformation. It's hidden. It's covert. It's routed through multiple channels. We talked about some of this last week. Some of the more effective disinformation campaigns during the Cold War and now, you know, they don't come from the source. The source is hidden. If you want to spread a disinformation campaign about the U.S. and Southeast Asia using genocidal germ warfare, you know, it doesn't come out of Hanoi, and it doesn't come out of Moscow. It came out of India through Britain to the United States. You know, that's the way it works. So disinformation, a couple of things to remember, it's hidden, not like propaganda generally. A couple of examples of propaganda that I posted on my blog post this week were some very good propaganda. Russia and China are both using their aid flights to the U.S. for some very positive propaganda. It's propaganda for their own populations, basically saying, hey, we got in front of this thing. We took control. You know, we're ahead of it. The Americans aren't. Look, we're shipping aid to them. This is the sort of thing the U.S. used to do during the week. We send aid to other people. No. Now we're receiving aid. So that's a good message from their standpoint in terms of trust. They're shopping that internally to a great extent. They're not shopping it so much in the U.S. Where they are shopping it is to the markets that they want to impress. They're shopping it. Russia's shopping that in Europe with that story and spreading it as far as possible in Europe. Strangely enough, China is spreading it widely in Latin America, which is one of their target markets for resources.
Okay, so, now stop right there for a second, because this is interesting. Now, some people would say, well, why aren't they shopping it in the U.S.? Because they don't have to. Here's the thing. In the U.S., if people are suspicious and still of the mindset that the communist boogeyman is the communist boogeyman, right, then they're automatically going to remain suspicious and say, well, gee, you know, we're getting stuff from China, but don't trust that anyway, because you can't trust them anyway. It's a win-win. The people that didn't trust them in the first place, the people that were looking for negativity in the first place, are still going to see negativity. The people, they might even take it to a more benign sort of level, where it's like, well, look at them. They're trying to assert their superiority over us by sending us help. On the other hand, somebody else who might be open-minded in this country might say, well, you know, perhaps they're being kind to us. Perhaps we're not adversaries anymore. Now, neither position do I agree with. I think it is a contextual thing. There is a context and texture, okay, to this, where it's not a simple black and white answer. I think that it is to assert superiority for the hometown crowd, like you said, and say, look at us. We're helping the poor Americans who are growing weaker. we are strong enough that we can offer them help in order to encourage, national, not pride necessarily, but something along those lines. Because now you can have faith in your own nation. Look, we're helping the United States. They're not as strong as they used to be. And when they play it in these other markets, like you said, in South America and Europe and some other places that we're probably not even thinking about, it also gets to play as, look, the United States is no longer. They get to belittle us in a way, even in a polite fashion. They needed help from us. So therefore, they must not be in as strong a position as we are. You might want to put your trust in us, the whole thing, right? So, I mean, literally, there's all of that going on simultaneously with an act like this. And that is propaganda that was from an action that you could claim, just humanitarian motivation alone. Say, look, we're a nation that has something to offer. We offered it. And on the surface, you can make that claim across the board, and it can be read so many different ways, depending on the audience that's receiving it, right?
Right, and it's especially successful. I mean, it is open. It's a true story. It's from a known news outlet. It's factual, which always represents the best propaganda. During wartime, the best propaganda is to broadcast both to your side and to the other side, your victories. Because the other side is liable to realize that they just lost big time and it's going to be very effective with them. And your folks know that they're winning. That's why some of the least effectual War II propaganda, as I mentioned, was from Tokyo Rose in Japan, because she was broadcasting to the American forces that were island hopping in the Pacific and winning and turning back the Japanese in virtually every engagement, and they knew they were winning. So her propaganda was pretty useless. The only more useless propaganda that I can think of is the broadcasts that were conducted out of Baghdad, about the fact, I don't know if, Chuck, you remember them, the Americans have not crossed the border, and just in the middle of one of those media events from the spokesperson, the tanks roll into the same square from where he's broadcasting. Now that, that's a fail from a propaganda standpoint. So propaganda is best and works well if it's true, if you reach a broad audience, if you're reputable as a source, people believe what you're saying. And that's why these contemporary examples are such good examples of propaganda. There's got to be truth to the story. As far as disinformation is concerned, there has to be a little truth. In fact, there has to be enough content in it so that it's credible. But that's all. Just a little bit. It's got to involve some known locations, some activities. It's got to be consistent with some of the things that are occurring movie terms, it would be continuity. There has to be some continuity to it, just enough to make it credible.
Right. We talked about this last week, indeed, about the fact that you have to include real places and a narrative that is similar to a real situation that is known helps. That's the thing, is you kind of craft it so that you have something that, that sounds reasonable. For some reason, doesn't necessarily mean it's verified by anything, except that, yes, there is truly a place. Yes, this kind of thing has happened before. Certainly, these are the behaviors that are possible in this scenario. In other words, you don't present something that is wholly incredible and has no bearing, no resemblance to something that has happened in the past. Something that is completely remarkable and brand new, you better bring a lot more evidence. But you can throw something that sounds familiar into an equation like that, and it flies a lot better, right?
Yeah, and you got to remember, for disinformation, that's not nearly as challenging, because you want to plant it. You want to plant it and get someone to repeat it. And if all possible, if the person who is repeating it is credible, their credibility sells it. It is kind of like advertising. We, with the use of spokespeople, you know, trusted spokespeople. You want people to sell products to folks who trust them and think that they're talking to them and not lying to them. You know,
right,
the
totally.
Message is much better if it comes from a spokesperson rather than directly from the corporate advertising head.
Right. Now, totally perfect example of this was the change. Okay, remember Papa John's Pizza? Right. And the Papa John's guy, you know, said some racist stuff and they got rid of him. Who did they bring out as a spokesperson? The guy that has no dirt on him whatsoever, Shaq. They brought him out as a spokesperson and, hey, look, I actually bought a Papa John's franchise and I'm delivering pizzas. And you know why? Because Shaq is like, you got no dirt on the guy. There is nothing negative anybody can say about him publicly. So, you know, first of all, it was an answer to, is Papa John's like racist pizza? Well, they actually, you know, purposely chose a man of color to be their spokesperson. And not only did they do that, but they chose a guy who has no dirt on him whatsoever in order so that they could have a squeaky clean image go forward like, no, wait a minute. This is the guy who really represents our company. And they changed their sales trajectory by doing that. They were starting to dive with that whole, you know, maybe we should, boycott Papa John's, right? And immediately when they came out with the Shaq campaign, that whole thing was shut down just like that. And that's the use of it in a commercial sense. But this is the kind of thing that you can do if you actually, they used Shaquille O'Neal's squeaky clean imagery, and I'm sure they paid him for it well, to sell the corporate image and to make sure that all these franchises all across the country didn't have to suffer from some mass boycott due to, you know, what the CEO had previously stated or whatever. Right? I mean, this is exactly how it's done. I mean, that is a matter of changing the narrative with propaganda. I mean, they did remove the guy who made the statements and all that, and truly, Shaquille O'Neal owns a couple of franchises now. So they took a real thing and said, no, this is actually the public face. So that was the use of, like, say, commercial propaganda. Taking it totally outside of the political realm. Does that sound right to you?
No, that's absolutely right. That's really what I was getting at, is these techniques. I mean, propaganda is marketing, vice versa. So when you're talking about propaganda, it's open. You know what the source is, and it needs to be credible. The big difference with disinformation is it's stealthy, and that's where we draw the line, and that's where your credit – that's one of the reasons why the internet – social networking and the contemporary electronic infrastructure that we have is actually so much more dangerous for disinformation than the previous outlets were. I mean, and in if you were circulating newspapers or buying TV or radio spots, you had to do that. You had to buy advertising. Or if the best you could hope is that you convinced an editor to do an editorial column that carried your viewpoint. And I can recall doing what were called advertorials. And, you know, it read like a news story, but it was really an advertisement. All of those are standard marketing techniques. Because they have to be standard because they're in a known media outlet from a known source. So, quite frankly, you can only get away with so much. You have to be largely telling the truth.
Yeah, I think they call it native advertising. I think they call that native advertising, where something looks like a news story, but it's actually a commercial, and it's usually scripted to appear as though it's a news story. And they do that in print. They do that in electronic media. They've been doing it for many years. But here's the funny part about that. Is now with the resounding echo chambers that result from the interconnectivity of the internet, you can take that native advertising and it might be represented by somebody else reposting it or sort of parroting it as a piece of news their source is that piece of native advertising, but now they've carried it out and called it a piece of news, attaching their credibility to it. And it's exponential with the way this spreads. Am I right or wrong?
You're right. And the first time I knew that we were getting into really deep waters and really big trouble, and I think I'm familiar with this, back around 2010, 2009, something like that, when I became aware of the phenomena of where basically manufacturers of clothing and sporting goods, the sort of stuff that you would target to people within the age groups of maybe 15 to 30, were beginning to plant sources on campuses. They would really go on campus. They would pay money to a sorority figure, a student body president. Basically, they would identify the biggest influencers on campus or the people that had the most read blogs or pages, whatever it was, and they would pay money and give them product to essentially write about and talk about how this is what I use and this is why I'm so great and this is why I'm so popular. And this was stealthy. There, it was hidden. I mean, it was those arrangements and those financial arrangements were not open, not like Shaq.
Right.
Yeah. They were, and this story was really starting to break as to how prevalent that was. And I'm going, oh Lord, you know, given the impact of social media, all you got to do is find one or two of the most popular kids on campus, and you just reach 50,000 people, 100,000 people. Amazing. That was the first warning of how exposed we were going to be to political warfare disinformation.
Right. Now, on the retail level, the way to earn propaganda that way, let's just, I don't know, we'll take something, again, completely outside of the realm. Sneakers, let's just say, right? What you would do is, if you were, oh, we'll pick a company, Nike's the one that comes to my mind, and I'm not going to get into the politics of it, but let's just imagine. If Nike turns around and donates a whole bunch of sneakers to, I don't know, athletic teams in poor communities, a news story gets generated from that. That's propaganda that Nike created. But if they're going to different influencers and getting them to, here's our product, here's some money, and what we want you to do is tell people how great our product is, but we're not really advertising with you, you're just influencing the situation, that becomes the disinformation style, because that's not necessarily known. The other one is earned, where a news story gets them exposure. And they actively do something, that's propaganda. But on the other hand, the other one is disinformation, where they've surreptitiously inserted themselves and made a deal with somebody and been like, push our products. And they do it in the course of whatever it is they're also doing, and that's that. And, you know, on some level, there's a lot of that that goes on. I mean, you know, look, musicians use certain guitars because they're usually paid by a guitar company if they're a well-known musician. But generally speaking, that guitar company will own that and say, look, we sponsor this guy. You know, but if you do it and nobody says anything about it and it's not an upfront sort of deal, then it was inserted for influence, right?
Yeah, this is more the, if anyone was old enough, and I doubt that there are many still around, to remember the payola in the record industry, where you went to the hottest DJ in a market and said, hey, you got to play this record more than any of the others, and you just got to say it's the best thing that's happening, and if you're not dancing to it, you're an idiot. You know, that was payola. This, in modern times, this is the equivalent of payola.
Right. I urge anybody to look that up. I mean, that's kind of an old concept. I'm familiar with it, but it was before my time, I think, that was going on, Larry, to be honest with you. But in the early days of rock and roll, I'm telling you now, there's a reason why certain artists got played all over the country and some did not. and this is why. So, anyway.
Chuck, it's just that there's hardly anything before my time these days. You know, what can I say?
Hey, look, I didn't make the joke. You did. But back to this, though, on a very serious level. And again, I know it seems like we've gone far afield here, but not really. Because as Larry explained, the idea of, you know, commercialism and selling a product and marketing, right? It works the same way. Marketing is politics. Politics is marketing. In fact, I would say that that's the majority of why it is you see politicians do anything, is for the fact that they are marketing to a particular target audience. And their target audience is in their district, in their voting block, whatever. And they're trying to score points with them, you know? They're trying to do that in some of this stuff, again, whether it is positive or negative in some cases. Sometimes disinformation is planted about individuals in political circles. You know, I don't know why this jumps to my mind, but the robocalls that went out about John McCain and how he had, you know, an illegitimate child and all that. There is a disinformation campaign, okay, which was not true, but went out there in order to disable him. See, look, I'm not just picking on one side of the equation or the other ever. And it was meant to incite in a certain, you know, in certain areas that were targeted by these robocalls, the idea that he was dishonest, untrustworthy. So sometimes these things are utilized not to just push a point, but sometimes they're used to undermine individuals or points as well, right?
Yeah, one of the classic examples of this, going back in time even further, let's go back to the ward politics in New York or Chicago or the big metropolitan areas. a guy would actually go out, come up with a collection of grubby-looking bums, equip them with political buttons and badges and signs of his opponent, and pay them around to go around knocking on doors and disturbing people and being annoying. I mean, that's kind of classic and negative campaigning. But amazingly, again, it works.
No, it was effective. Look at who supports this guy. Well, if I was undecided before, never mind. Yeah. That's true, but I'm just saying it works on many different levels. And when you're looking at what you're writing about and creating chaos, right, some of these things are not so sophisticated like what you just brought up. Not a very sophisticated but still effective way of dealing with the situation. Doesn't require a lot of technology or anything. I wonder if people do that today, though. Like send intentionally annoying people as, like, false supporters. Political. I don't know if that's done so much because – I don't know. It's almost weird when you see. Yes, go ahead.
I'm pretty sure it's done. It was done in the 2016 elections with planted Facebook pages. And I'll give you an example. And this is where we need to kind of, I think, move it into political warfare. Because mm-hmm. It is here now with us. All of those same tactics are here. But we talked about propaganda being, it can be positive or negative. Generally, it works best if it's positive, because, again, it's coming from a known source. So, you know, if you've got a good story to tell and it's from a known source and there's no doubt that it's largely true, it really is the most effective. When we move into political warfare and disinformation and we work with stealthy sources, they use all the same tactics, but it's almost always negative. And the reason it's negative is that's what they're appealing to. Disinformation works best when you're scaring someone, when you want to increase tensions, when you want to heat things up, when you want to, you can target it well enough so that your target group is already concerned about something, already scared about something, already sensitive to something. Disinformation works best with a sensitized population. And the example you and I were talking about that we talked about last week of spreading disinformation about the U.S. using chemical, biochemical warfare in Southeast Asia was already a hot button for nations like India when that campaign was started. Right. And that's why it works best. And that's one of the benefits that the internet gives to it with the kind of targeting that can be done on the internet. I write a lot about that. We did not see that sort of thing until 2015, 2016, with the type of demographic information and, quite frankly, the type of commercial information that was available. We now know that the Russian troll campaign used some of the same sources that were used in the political campaigns of 2016. This stuff was made commercially available. When you answered those cute, fun surveys on Facebook, somebody skimmed it off and weaponized it for a database. Mm-hmm. So thinking about disinformation and thinking about it as being weaponized, it needs to be targeted to somebody who's already got a concern, who's already sensitized, and it doesn't have to come from nearly as credible a source then, because quite frankly, to scare all of us, our filters and our criteria are not nearly as great for negative news as they are for positive news. It's like, mm-hmm. how many people, it's like, you just got a, you know, $1 million check from, you know, a magazine publishing group. I don't believe that. Well, I heard a noise outside the house. Now, yeah, I'm probably up to something being a problem. And I don't want to belabor that point, but that's why political fragmentation, these tools work best with people that are already sensitized if I can identify them, and if I can route it through a source that's even a little bit, not necessarily trusted, but simply aligned with their thought processes, they buy it almost instantly. There is no fact checking. We learned that in 2016, and we're still learning it now. All you've got to do is tell somebody that's already in a certain pattern of thinking something they want to hear, and they will not fact check it. And matter of fact, they won't even go to any place where they could fact check it.
Well, matter of fact, Larry, they won't even read beyond the headline. And that's the interesting thing, is that this is why clickbait is a useful marketing tool. If you got the right headline, if you got the right hot button words, you got the right key thing going on, like in the early days of this, coronavirus thing, quite frankly, any podcast that was, tagged with the word coronavirus, literally went viral, pardon the pun. It was like, you know, we saw podcasts increase in their reach overnight in a huge way. And it was because people were looking for it on the internet. They were looking for information when this first started to become, you know, I see it very much as fear porn. I really do, because look, regardless of what the threat is, the constant drumming of deaths and keeping tallies and be afraid, be very afraid is there. Not sensible, like, you know, look, we're finally getting around to, well, maybe you should wear a mask in public. I don't know how helpful that is or anything. I'm just saying, you know, now they're getting around to maybe you can do something. But for a long little while there was nothing but a whole lot of be afraid, be terrified. And it's interesting to note all of this now. I want to cut back to the Vladimir Putin aspect of this. And why? Because he's the central figure, in my estimation, in creating chaos, okay? So I have a big question for you, and I want to give you the rest of the time to try and discuss it. Of course, go over to Larry-Hancock.com to follow up on this discussion. There are links to get many, many books by Larry. Creating Chaos is the one we're discussing tonight, but I wanted to get that in so I can allow you all the time that's left to explain something to me. And that is, you know, from what you see, a lot of people talk to me about the goals that Putin had in mind. What is the Russian campaign about? We know about many of the different mechanisms. We know about some of the troll farms. We know about the possibilities. We know about how they leveraged already, you know, boiling under the surface things and kind of lanced the boil, if you will, to get some of the pus to come forward. That was the effort. But let me ask you, what was the ultimate goal of the strategy outside of destabilization? Was there any other discernible goal that you could see here to the campaign of propaganda, disinformation, and quite frankly, there was a whole lot of elements of psychological warfare that I think were employed by the Russian Federation at the behest of Vladimir Putin over the past many years? Do you have an idea of what the discernible goal is outside of, again, some sort of fragmentation here domestically? We are not the only target, by the way. It's not as though we are the only ones that are being targeted here. But the point is, outside of that and trying to assert Russian supremacy in a way on the political stage globally, is there any other agenda that you can discern from the activities that you go through in creating chaos?
Fortunately, yes. Therefore, I have something to say. Otherwise, it'd be embarrassing. But for those who do happen to have creating chaos, if you read chapter 10 and 11, sovereignty issues and pushing back, the good thing about it is if you parse through, Putin is very straightforward. And if you parse through his public statements, and you can just pick about a half a dozen, he tells you what his concern is and exactly what he's going to do about it. And what his concern is, and it's this concern and this whole strategy and this whole program did not really begin to develop until around 2014. And it developed largely because of events in Georgia and the Ukraine. And Putin's worldview is simply that Russia should be, always has been, and is entitled to essentially a global area, a sphere of influence. He wants a sphere of influence. And the sphere of influence he wants is very comparable to the Russian Empire. He's not unhappy, you know, give him all of Eastern Europe, part of the Middle East, now probably some of Africa, bigger stage, and influence over Western Europe, and he's fine. He feels that, and he has stated that, and he's actually drawn those lines and said that the Russian sphere of influence needs to be greater than its political boundaries, and it needs to be treated with respect, and it needs not to be interfered with. And his view of the world was up through the Ukrainian elections of 2014, the West was inserting itself into his domain and literally wanted to take control of Russia. So he feels that he is simply responding to an attack on Russian sovereignty. Okay, fine. So he says that's his motive. I see no reason to argue with man if he says that in public. And he is refreshingly straightforward about it. He has a clear motive. He has a clear strategy. And his strategy is, I'm going to make you look elsewhere. You've been looking at me. You've been pushing on my sphere of influence. I need Europe to be concerned about itself, not me. Don't stop your intrusions into those nations that were part of the USSR, need to be under my political and economic control, not yours. Get back. Okay? And so, as you said, Chuck, we can trace out this campaign, this political warfare. His first target, America was not at all his first targets. His first targets were France and Britain as the two primary players in the EU and in NATO. And if you look at what he's managed to accomplish, he almost tore apart NATO. He almost tore apart the EU. And he forced Britain back on themselves by helping them play on their own domestic issues and fears. And so he accomplished that first before he really turned on us. Then he decided that was working well. If I can fragment them and make them look internally rather than towards me, you know, forget, get them away from any grand strategy, I can do the same thing the U.S. And I got to tell you, he did not have to drive anything. All he had to do was look and say, what's going on in the United States that would fragment them and make them look internally? Aha, there's a political campaign going on over there that says America first. You know, forget this global nonsense. America before everyone else. Look internally. That's what I want them to do. If I can encourage that, then that will be just really great. They will be butting out of my affairs. So the more I can convince them to turn internally and away from a global view, the happier I am.
See,
short answer, long answer.
No, I got you. And the odd thing is that, you know, I have one weird open question to sort of challenge what you just said. But I also have another thing to add, which is that this also means that you can't pay very much attention if he launches serious campaigns in places like the Ukraine, while he's reabsorbing Crimea, while he's, you know what I'm saying? In other words, other movements are going on here at the same time, and no attention will be paid or little. Plus, he can build alliances which could in the future translate into other relationships with the Russian Federation. That's all going on, but one would wonder, why is it that Putin did not attempt to support somebody like Ron Paul, who would have been, well, a lot more beneficial to him as far as getting America to look inside of itself as opposed to looking internationally? Because Ron Paul certainly did not want to engage any longer in these foreign wars, according to his rhetoric. So it almost seems like he probably should have supported Ron Paul if he could have thought there was a real way. See, I guess I'm about to answer my own question. Ron Paul's candidacy didn't have the possibilities that the Trump candidacy did, and certainly would not have gotten the same media attention that the Trump campaign got, right? So I guess it was just right moment in history to seize upon it, so that way look into yourselves, struggle with each other, and stop looking at me. And in fact, you know, if I can behave a little bit friendly with this guy, a little bit of juicing of the ego, guess what else I get? Secondary propaganda out of it. Russia's not the problem, folks. Right?
Well, I think there's a secondary element, too, I'm just guessing, is that there was an economic component to Trump's campaign that wasn't there with Ron Paul. Ron Paul is isolationist, which, you know, is good from Putin's standpoint.
Would have been helpful to him, yeah.
Trump is America first in terms of economics, manufacturing. Basically, what if you were Putin, what would you want more than anything else in terms of facilitating your economic outreach? Wouldn't it be handy if the U.S. started engaging with trade wars and tariffs? And so that aspect of Trump's candidacy was clear from the very beginning. So I would just say that would be another it's not that Putin will not do those same things if he needs to, but if we're doing them, he doesn't have to. He proved that he absolutely could control the oil flow, the gas flow to Western Europe in a very harsh fashion. And that's what lost him his first round. I think he's probably smart enough to say, well, geez, if I am an SOB to Western Europe, they'll recognize it. But if the U.S. is an SOB to Western Europe, I'm good.
Well, see, and that's the interesting thing here is that, you know, as we come down to the last couple of minutes, is to add this whole agreement with Saudi Arabia, which dropped the price of oil drastically, right, at precisely the right time. You know, the destabilization there is not just economic, but is a longer-term strategy. here's what it does immediately in the energy markets is, you know, the U.S., who had developed some of these other things like shale oil and, you know, fracking and all these other things, which I'm not a big fan of, but economically, it makes more sense when you have the U.S. not so reliant on foreign oil. Well, here's the thing. The bottom line is what counts with a corporation, is what counts with energy distributors in this country. So here's the thing. If there's a $20 barrel of foreign oil, right, versus a, you know, what would effectively be $60 worth of the same energy domestically, you try and figure out if $40 is worth the transportation. And if it is, you'll take the foreign oil. I mean, it's about the bottom line. There's a reason why Apple put all of its factories in China, because that was the cheapest place to manufacture their crap. It's just that simple. So you can shift a lot of things by turning around and seeming to do something that is almost counterintuitive to your own financial benefit. But in the long run, it could actually shift the focus. If you can, you know, look, I'll keep the oil prices low, keep buying the oil from over here. And if that's cheaper than producing it domestically, guess what's going to happen? That's where the business is going to go. You know, and these things are done, you know, on a day-to-day basis in the energy markets. So quite frankly, all you got to do is shift things around for a little bit. The overwhelming overhead of the domestic producer could crush itself if you have no way to keep the revenue stream going. And this is a strategic concern, which is not only financial, but again, increases the sphere of influence of somebody who has the ability. I mean, why is it that anybody cares about what goes on in Saudi Arabia? Okay? Because why is it anybody cares about a lot of Middle Eastern nations that normally nobody would have any business poking their nose into? Well, it's because if we don't do X, Y, Z, we're going to have problems with oil producers, right? So yep. This is part of the paradigm that needs to be recognized at all times, and Putin has played into this very, very well. Again, I don't know. I don't remember how much you focused on energy, but I do know you discussed this a bit in creating chaos, not the current events, but the idea that he has that switch in his briefcase of switches, Vladimir Putin
and,
does.
And actually, Chuck, I go into that at great length in his first engagement with Western Europe. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, he threw the switch the wrong direction then, and it really kind of blew apart his first outreach. He's a man who learns quickly. This time, he's throwing the switch the other direction, kind of like, I can afford to price to help you, you know.
Right.
It's not a problem. I can do that. So, you know, in this case, I think back to the overall topic, political warfare is part information warfare and part economic warfare, and he's playing both parts.
See, that's the key. You went into that historical reality, which is not that long ago. But here's the thing. Like you said, it didn't work. So he looked at that switch and said, you know, if I turn it in the other direction, it'll do something different. And, yeah, it's not as though it is an unfounded concept to influence the situation. And, again, overall, what that results in at the end of the day is the expansion of his sphere of influence. And the more you play in that market, the more you can gain influence. I mean, it's just the law of the jungle at this point. But meanwhile, Larry-Hancock.com is the website. The book we were talking about tonight is Creating Chaos. And in a couple of weeks, probably, and I'm going to see if I can schedule it with Larry as soon as possible, we're going to talk about the book In Denial, which I have not gotten to read yet. But I do have in my hands, as of today, a reviewer copy. Is that one available for purchase already?
You can pre-purchase the Kindle version. They wouldn't, for some reason, let us pre-release purchase the print version. They'll both be available for purchase on the 17th of this month.
So April 17th, In Denial will be available. But Creating Chaos is available now. I'll give you the links in the show notes. And this show is all over with, but until next time, remember, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night. Yeah.
brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Shelley.
A reminder that this is the Voice of America broadcasting worldwide.
The age of transistors.
Warning.
Uncle, the podcast.
The O'Shelley effect.
It's the Aphrodite.
Really.
Orkin's Policy Radio with Pierce Redmond.
O'Shelley.com. 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 O'Shelley.com.